Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, why is China winning the technology race, particularly with autonomous cars? And first, COVID has worsened prison conditions worldwide. What are the human rights implications of the pandemic on prisons? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. The COVID-19 pandemic has created challenges in prisons and prisoner rights all over the world. Prison crowding and subpar living conditions have created ideal breeding grounds for the virus. On today's show, we examine how the pandemic has threatened the human rights of the incarcerated all over the world, including here in the United States. Our guests are John Raefling, senior researcher for Human Rights Watch and author of Averting an Imminent Catastrophe, Recommendations to U.S. Local, State, and Federal Officials to COVID-19 in Jails and Prisoners. And Steve Swerdlow, Associate Professor of the Practice at the University of Southern California. He has conducted extensive field research internationally with a particular focus on Central Asia and the Caucasus. He also works as a consultant with the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom. John Raefling, I'll ask you first, what are some of the human rights challenges that COVID-19 have posed for prisoners for the incarcerated?
Sure, thanks. And thanks for having me on the show. To begin with, as you alluded to in the introduction, prisons like cruise ships, like, you know, convalescent homes, where people are packed in living closely together, are just horrific breeding grounds for disease in general, for upper respiratory disease in particular, and especially for virulent disease like COVID-19. And so as the pandemic has spread, jails and prisons have been breeding grounds that have been almost uncontrollable, or have not been controlled. I won't say it's been uncontrollable. They've not been controlled. And it's had a terrible effect within the institutions. And additionally, the disease has passed in and out. People who come into jail cycle in and out on a fairly short timetable and are bringing the disease in and bringing it back out into the surrounding community. Corrections officers, guards, other staff at jails and prisons bring the disease in, bring it out. And so, one, it's a humanitarian nightmare within the jails and prisons themselves. Two, it's contributing to the further spread outside of those institutions.
And Steve Swerdlow, John Raefling's describing a lot of what's going on in the United States. I imagine in a number of places around the world, particularly lesser developed countries, the conditions could be even worse. Is that true?
And also, thank you for having me. I think it's a really appropriate time in which we're having this conversation on the cusp of MLK Day, Martin Luther King Day, because of course he was a prominent political prisoner. And during COVID-19, as John said, in the US and also internationally, the human rights community is profoundly concerned about the additional risks that COVID-19 places on prisoners' rights, and then in particular on political prisoners' rights. One of the, you know, just to add to the concerns that John raised about ensuring health and access to health care and just the inherent risks of overcrowding, we also see during this time of COVID-19 across the world, reduced access to justice, reduced access to counsel, to your lawyer. The inability of legal counsel being able to file motions in court on behalf of their imprisoned clients, get access to them in pretrial detention and in prison. And that, of course, opens up a whole world of possibilities for authorities to, you know, interrogate suspects without due process. We're seeing just a lot more risk of politically motivated prosecution and a whole number of concerns, which is what led the WHO and the UN Office on Drugs and Crime, the European Commission, and a whole host of institutions to issue guidelines at the beginning of the pandemic. I think it was around April or May, calling on states to not only ensure the rights and of access to healthcare that prisoners should enjoy, but also really to reduce overcrowding, start releasing prisoners. And unfortunately, almost a year into this, we really haven't seen that take place.
John Raefling, there's lots of stories about prisoners being released, being allowed, you know, to be under house arrest rather than necessarily incarcerated in the prison. Are those stories deceptive at presenting an image of quite a large number of prisoners being released? Or are there actually a number of American prisoners that have been released to try to reduce some of the prison overcrowding?
There's variation by jurisdiction. In understanding the U.S. criminal legal system, you have to understand that there's the federal system. Each of the states has their own system. And then within the states, each county has their own way of doing things. And even on this issue, each police department may have its own procedures and processes. So there's a variety of responses. Some places early on in the pandemic, a couple of police departments, I believe Tucson and Philadelphia, said, look, we're not going to make custodial arrests of people on certain lower level charges. We're going to give them citations and have them ordered to come into court. Other police departments, the vast majority, said business as usual, even though by bringing people into custody, they're exposing their own officers and their own staff, as well as everyone else who's going through the system, to close contact and potential infection. Similarly, so that's at one level. And I'm not saying that Philadelphia or Tucson kept up with those policies. They announced them initially. I'm not sure how systematically they upheld those policies. In Los Angeles County, for example, there was initially a pretty substantial reduction in jail population. There was an effort by the courts and with some cooperation from the sheriff, DAs, public defenders, working together to get people out of custody. And so they did. They reduced the numbers from something like 17,000 to about 12,000 at the lowest, which sounds great until you realize that 12,000 was the actual capacity of the jail. They just went from being vastly overcrowded to the amount, the population it should be without a pandemic. And since then, the population has gone back up, maybe not to the full pre-pandemic numbers. That's been the pattern in a number of places. There's been a lot of talk about, oh yeah, we should lower jail and prison populations, but the action has been relatively minor. There've been some releases, kind of enough to make it look good politically and to make some of the policymakers feel like, well, you know, we've done something. We let 300 people out. You've got 5,000 people in the jail. The standard, right, to what would actually be an adequate response is, the standard is that you have to have the enough space in the jail to where people can maintain social distance, plain and simple, just like for us on the outside, and to where people can be, who have symptoms, who have been had contact, can be separated from other people in a non-punitive way. And this is a very important thing, because what reports that I've been getting and have been hearing consistently are that people in jails, and especially in prisons, are afraid to report symptoms because they know they'll be set into solitary confinement, which is punitive and at a certain point can veer into actually being torture. And so people don't want to get put in solitary confinement. And so they keep quiet about their symptoms, continuing to infect other people. So there's a variety of issues around it that bottom line comes down to, if you don't reduce the jail or prison populations, you're going to continue to have a dangerous spread. By dangerous, I mean, we're talking about large numbers of people dying.
And John, actually, as a quick follow-up, those who sure. are being released, what types of crimes are they typically convicted of if they're being released?
Good question. And the use of the word convicted of, A lot of the people who are getting released are people who were being held pre-trial, as in they were in jail and hadn't been convicted of anything. Now that leads into a whole other set of issues and human rights issues around pretrial incarceration and the coercion inherent in holding people who haven't been convicted of crime. So one of the things that has happened is the politically easier approach has been to release people who are being held being held pretrial for relatively lower level offenses. And so, for example, in California, the Judicial Council at one point set something, a $0 bail schedule for most offenses. Meaning if you get arrested, your bail is set at zero, so you're going to get released. In other words, we're not going to do pretrial incarceration. And it was actually relatively successful. I mentioned the time period when there was reductions in jail populations. That was one of the things that was a big help. Well, law enforcement doesn't like it because it reduces their level of control. And they went on a big kind of media blitz about all the crime going up, which was not actually supported by facts and data. So decisions are being made about who to release and who not to release. The recommendations obviously are to start with people who are most vulnerable. Courts and law enforcement want to release people on the lowest level crimes to the extent they want to release people. But you know, again, there's a range, and it depends on the commitment to actually ensuring safety. You know, sadly, that commitment has been lacking.
Now, Steve, certainly all prisoners have rights, and these concerns with prison conditions really are true regardless of what they've been accused of or convicted of. But in particular, those political prisoners, people who are, you know, imprisoned for questionable offenses, are particularly egregious. Has COVID made those types of prisoners all the more vulnerable?
It has. We saw the death in July, for example, in prison of a very prominent political prisoner named Azim John Askarov, who was actually a human rights activist in prison 10 years earlier, a member of an ethnic minority group in Kyrgyzstan, but also really a prominent human rights activist and journalist. And the human rights community had been advocating for his release for many, many years. But when COVID happened, it was yet another blow. And the diagnosis upon his death that the authorities was released was pneumonia. So it was hard to prove definitively that he died of coronavirus, although the symptoms and you know, all the indicators were that this was a COVID death. But really what killed him was the lack of humanity, the cruelty with which he and many other political prisoners have been treated in this period, which is just a blatant disregard for the basic and fundamental human rights obligations that states have. You know, one guideline, which is relevant again to John's report, are the UN standards for the treatment of prisoners, which are called the Nelson Mandela rules, which were named in honor of him, the most famous political prisoner, which really give the baseline standards on overcrowding, on other standards that have to be met. But as you said, political prisoners are under extreme risk because, you know, when governments want to silence or muzzle the messenger, again, COVID-19, in a way, it allows an additional level of, you know, it's an additional excuse that authorities can use to really keep these people far away from the press, far away from their families. So I just got back from Uzbekistan, where I was doing some research for the past few months on political prisoners and religious prisoners. And there was several cases that I was trying to raise with the government where, you know, in lieu of actually releasing these prisoners, at least I was making the argument that the authorities should be willing to place people into house arrest. And indeed, there were many, many cases in which family members would contact me and say, you know, my father is 68 years old in a prison in the middle of Uzbekistan. And there's simply no justification for why so many states around the world, from Saudi Arabia, China, Iran, Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, seem to be disregarding this really clear advice that they're getting from the High Commissioner for Human Rights in Geneva, from, as I said, the Office on Drugs and Crime, Many different institutions have been really unanimous in calling for human rights standards to be applied. But when it comes to political prisoners, I think what COVID-19 does is just really ups the stakes. And it means we have to fight even harder to get these people out as quickly as we can.
You're listening to Scholar Circle. I'm Doug Becker. We're discussing the impact of the pandemic on the human rights of prisoners, and in particular, political prisoners, with John Raefling and Steve Swerdlow. So, John Raefling, one of the issues that has sort of been burning with me is whether or not this pandemic might change some of the discourse about criminal procedures and about prisons. You had mentioned that where you're seeing these cases where prisoners are being released are really pretrial incarceration. I know here in California, there's been a lot of conversation about bail reform and those sorts of issues. Do you foresee the experiences we've had with COVID having any sort of an impact on just broadly the question of how often people are incarcerated before they even face trial?
That's a really good question, and one that I'm hopeful about. I mentioned earlier they instituted statewide for a short period of time this $0 bail, which kept a large number of people who would otherwise be held pretrial, it kept them out of custody. It didn't take the judicial council, the sort of governing body of the California judiciary, very long before they reversed that $0 bail order. But there was a period of time where we had it, and we still have one in place in Los Angeles County, where we were able to see that it wasn't some crime disaster, right? Releasing all of these people. So it does give us as advocates and as people who are looking at this issue in good faith, a model of, you know, a time period when pretrial incarceration was reduced, and it was not a disaster. And in fact, it worked fairly well. So the problem, of course, is that you have some very entrenched and powerful interests within our legal system that very much rely on the use of pretrial incarceration, and that felt very threatened by the reduction in incarceration altogether that at least started in response to the pandemic. And they've resisted it, and resisted it again with fatal consequence, right? And this is particularly law enforcement, but the judges, prosecutors have strongly resisted the large scale level of release of people from jails and prisons that's necessary to ensure safety. So the question will be whether they're willing to give up an element of power that they get from the ability to incarcerate within the system, and whether they're willing to sort of acknowledge the human necessity of winding down incarceration.
And Steve, internationally, has the pandemic opened up any new areas of discourse, of discussion about the use of incarceration for certain types of crimes?
Well, yeah. I mean, on one level, it further underlines or highlights the need for organizations like the International Committee for the Red Cross to finally get access to countries that have closed them off for years and not allow them to monitor prison conditions. So, for example, that's the situation that I know best in my neck of the woods in Central Asia. The International Committee for the Red Cross has been blocked from visiting prisons in Tajikistan, in Turkmenistan, in Uzbekistan, some of the world's most repressive regimes, for many years. And I think COVID-19 only makes it more, the fierce urgency of now to get them access to so they can do their job and monitor conditions. But I think also on a level of international human rights law and standards for prisons in particular, I do see that you know, there's a chorus of organizations that are doing the equivalent of what John is advocating for the U.S. is a rethink, a reexamination of the standards that should apply, and the fundamental the problem of human dignity that's not being addressed. We've seen, I don't know what the tally is of how many prisoners have now died worldwide since the COVID-19 epidemic has begun. It's definitely in the thousands worldwide. And so Penal Reform International and many other organizations have been really trying to remind us of the basic standards that should apply, but that alternatives to incarceration have to be used as much as possible. And like I said, we also see these other concerns where access for lawyers are being cut off. We see the use of online court hearings happening, which is a good thing, of course, increasing access to justice. You know, people in rural regions who can't travel need to have access to justice. And so they're using online courts, but of course there are a lot of drawbacks involved in that. What happens when a judge, you know, turns off the video and ends the hearing prematurely and you can't access your fundamental rights, your due process that is due to you? So there are pluses and minuses that, you know, have to do with things. Not also, globalization in general is leading to a lot of changes in the way criminal justice is being handled across the world. But I think at the heart of this, we have to remind states that they have certain key obligations, and that even in times of emergency, I think all the international human rights norms point us in one direction, that even when you have a state of emergency, and maybe the COVID-19 qualifies as such, there are certain things that cannot be derogated from, certain fundamental rights. And that's the deprivation of liberty. You need access to your lawyer. You need access to all your fundamental due process rights. And in terms of political prisoners, just to remind us that we didn't define who they are. These are people whose rights have been, whose imprisonment, I should say, is related to the denial of a basic fundamental right, the right to practice their religion, the right to freely assemble, freely associate, express themselves, so journalists, human rights defenders. And I think there needs to be, I'm hoping, of course, that we'll see, you know, with this new administration coming in a few days, we'll see a renewed commitment around the world and a renewed focus on incarceration around the world and political prisoners within that.
Steve raises a really interesting issue, John, in that human rights internationally have generally been somewhat reliant on the U.S. speaking authoritatively about human rights. But on this issue, and in particular, both prison conditions and also over-sentencing for certain types of crimes, the United States not only is far from perfect, but even in comparison with, say, its European allies, the U.S. seems to be particularly challenged, if not just on the wrong side of a lot of those issues. Is there any potential for movement where issues for over-sentencing, in particular for things like nonviolent crimes, like drug possessions or economic types of crimes, that a recognition that the United States needs to rethink some of the sentencing guidelines?
So the United States for some time has been the world's leader in incarceration. And when you look at what we incarcerate for, it runs a whole spectrum from, you know, serious violent crimes down to, you know, crimes related to drug use, sex work. We criminalize sitting on the sidewalk and sleeping in a car, right? Like, we have a vast array of criminal laws that we use incarceration and other punishment as a response to. But even further and even deeper is that we address societal problems in the United States through policing, prosecutions, and prisons, as opposed to actually investing in uplifting communities, in services, in healthcare, things of that nature. So the United States has not set a good example for the rest of the world, and very much is lagging in that regard. More optimistically, though, in recent years, there has really been building a more powerful movement to change this. And it's really coming from the local, but building out to, you know, all levels of government. But, you know, particularly I'm in the Los Angeles area, a strong local movement removed a district attorney who was very committed to the old punishment paradigm and made it possible for a district attorney who has promised to unwind some of that punishment to replace her. A strong local movement built past Measure J in Los Angeles County, which basically allocates funding to services and support and care and not to incarceration and away from policing and incarceration. There have been a series of measures at the state level that have changed some of the most harsh punishment reform on the three strikes law, Prop 57, Prop 47, which reduced some of the punishments for these crimes. And these have been generated because of local, statewide, and national organizing by people within the communities that have been really ravaged by these punitive policies. So, so there is reason for optimism because there is this movement that continues to build. But, you know, again, we see law enforcement and the law enforcement bureaucracy clings to power and reacts, and there's money and power in all of these laws and systems.
And I'd be remiss to just identify COVID as what's driving this, because certainly the Black Lives Matter protests, the defund the police movement as a result of the murder of George Floyd, probably have much more of an impact on those questions than even COVID, though it's hard to delink those two, that the pandemic and the defund the police movement raising a number of issues. But Steve, I also wanted to ask you, I know that there have been a number of cases of political prisoners who have died as a result of COVID, been infected as a result of COVID. Do you have any specific examples that you can share?
Well, in July, an imprisoned Iranian journalist named Narghiz Mohammadi wrote in a letter, "Our bodies are ruined. There are 12 of us in the ward who have come down with the coronavirus." And she was writing from Iran's Zanjan prison. And she writes, "In the last few days since the disease was discovered, they separated us from the healthy people. There are absolutely no facilities nor medical care here in the ward. We don't even have hand sanitizer. They just give us ibuprofen. I feel totally paralyzed from the knees down and I can't breathe. I'm thinking this is the end of the line and that I won't make it until morning, that it's all over and done with." And, you know, I think her words really sum up just how awful, just how catastrophically this situation has affected prisoners and political prisoners around the world. I'm also thinking of people I know that I've advocated for in Tajikistan, a political activist named Rahmatullah Rajab, or a human rights lawyer also in prison there, named Buzurg Meryorov, an ex-diplomat that I know in Uzbekistan named Kadir Yusupov. All these are individuals who seem to have come down with COVID. Their lives are at risk. And I think those words that Narghiz wrote just should inspire us to redouble our efforts and, you know, speak truth to power and make sure that states know that they can't renege on their obligations and that they have to be held accountable. And there's really simply no excuse, no reason, as John has so clearly laid out in the US case and in others, that alternative solutions can't be pursued. And this should be a time, you know, if there's any bright line to this terrible tragedy and pandemic, it should be a clarity that we receive about what human rights we all have, including the most vulnerable of us in detention, in prison, around the world.
Yes, and a reminder that human rights is a concept. We all have human rights irrespective of our behavior, and in particular, the most vulnerable are the ones that are the most demanding for the respect of human rights. So I'm hoping that the conversations about the impact of COVID in prisons raise the specter of the need for reform on how we treat prisons, how we treat prisoners, and what kinds of sentences that we give for crimes, what kinds of incarceration before somebody is convicted, and ultimately the way we treat those that we find in our prison system. We've been discussing COVID and the impact on prisons. Our guests have been John Raefling, senior researcher for Human Rights Watch and the author of Averting an Imminent Catastrophe, Recommendations to U.S. Local, State, and Federal Officials to COVID-19 in Jails and Prisoners. And Steve Swerdlow, associate professor of the practice at the University of Southern California. He's conducted extensive field research internationally, and with a particular focus on Central Asia and the Caucasus. He also works as a consultant for the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
When we come back, with a long track record in winning the race for technology, why is the United States losing to China in the race for autonomous cars? Stay with us. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. The United States has a great track record in winning the technology race, but China is ahead with autonomous cars.
What explains this shift, and what role might government policy and priority have? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. The United States has great pride in its history as a technology leader globally. But in the race for the autonomous car, China appears to be winning. We explore the status of this race, the value of autonomous vehicles, and some of the reasons why China might be beating the United States to develop this technology, and what the U.S. might do to close the gap. We speak with Philip Wilcox. He's recently written and published the book, The Future is Autonomous: The U.S. and China Race to Develop the Driverless Car. Dr. Wilcox, thanks for joining us. First of all, what ultimately is the motivation behind developing autonomous vehicles?
Well, I guess the motivation for me will be what really got me interested in the field was an accident back in 2012 in which I had a really bad fall. And this left me with, among other injuries, legal blindness. So I cannot see at all out of my left eye, and I have vision problems out of my right eye, somewhat tunnel vision. So because of this, I cannot own a vehicle, or I can own it, but I can't drive it because I can't have a driver's license. So that is something that me and millions of other blind and disabled people have to suffer with. The problem is, like, for the ADA, which is going back, I think, on what, 40 years now of being in service. It's a really great law was passed. But I think that one of the big problems is why a lot of the people in the blind disabled community have, you know, lower wages, lower opportunities for education, things like that, is a bit of transportation. And so I think that the autonomous cars or self-driving cars, whatever you want to call it, will offer a lot of opportunity in that regard. So that's from my perspective. From the world's perspective, the U.S. perspective, would be, a lot of it is maybe boils down to safety. As you can see, there's over 35,000 deaths per year in the U.S. alone due to traffic accidents, and 1.35 million worldwide every year are killed, and numerous other people are injured as well, beyond just the deaths. So when you talk to any company in both the China and the U.S., they say the number one concern is safety.
Yeah, no, one group that has advocated for more self-driving vehicles is the Mothers Against Drunk Driving, and the emphasis in particular on the challenge of ensuring that drunk drivers are off the road, that their advocacy for Uber certainly has been motivated by that. And the self-driving car could even take that one step further. Do you think self-driving cars are safer than people driving themselves?
Well, for one thing, I have to say that right now, depending on where you live, you might have seen cars driving around with no one behind the wheel, or someone who is behind the wheel but is not actively monitoring the vehicle, doesn't have their hands on the steering wheel. But those vehicles are test vehicles. They're operating in a lot of cases in areas like San Francisco, Arizona, Pittsburgh, some parts of D.C., places like that. And right now, I'd say no, but it all depends on what vehicle you're talking about as well. So the trucking has actually been picking up a lot of steam recently, autonomous trucks. People think that that's really frightening if you see a truck driving by with no one operating it. But in some cases, the technology is easier that way, because if there is a situation in which a human driver is in front, is followed closely by the driver with the truck with no driver, then the technology is pretty simple. Assuming that it's close enough where no one can jump in and out or anything, but in that sense. So in that sense, technology is a little bit easier to manage. And you're also on highways, open highways, so there's less craziness. Like if you're in LA, downtown LA, trying to get anywhere, then there'll be lots of chaos going around. There's people, there's cars, there's whatever the case may be. So I think right now there's a lot of testing going on, and it's that the possibility, or not the possibility, the potential is just enormous to reduce the life. But the question you go back to is how safe is safe enough? And that's something that is very difficult to answer, because you know, what are the benchmarks? Like, what are the standards that you need to reach that point? Because we don't have that right now. And that's something that'd be a problem for, yeah, the industry.
And one of the things that struck me about the book and about this race for autonomous cars is how it appears as though China is ahead of the U.S. But when it comes to technology, the U.S. typically has seen is having some structural advantages. The vast majority of patents that are filed in G7 countries, you know, the group of seven developed countries, and in particular in the United States. And the comparisons between patents in the US and China are really quite vast. What is it about this campaign that seems to be allowing China to try to make up for some of the structural disadvantages they have in the race for technology?
Well, I'd say one thing is that the difference between China and the U.S. is not as fast as you point out, given that recently China actually surpassed the U.S. in terms of patents filed for science and technology as of the last year, and I'm sure it's continued till this year as well. So that is something that's it's interesting to follow. I would say actually that China is not necessarily beating the U.S. in this race. I'd say the U.S. is still ahead technologically, because we've been in terms of autonomous vehicles, because we've been working on it for much longer, companies in the U.S. So, for example, if you go back to the first DARPA Grand Challenges, that were just races in like the Mojave Desert to see who would go drive a vehicle autonomously for as long as they could. Those were from 2004 to 2007. And the first Chinese startup company for autonomous vehicles or AVs would be like 2016. So that's what, a 12-year head start. And like a lot of the things, the technology, it gets better as you drive. So, you know, the more you can fine-tune things and, you know, drive endless miles on roads and through simulations, the better the system will get. So the time is definitely a factor in this. But I wouldn't say, I'd say that for one thing is that the China doesn't have like these sort of these name brands like a Google or Amazon or things like that. You might have things like Alibaba and stuff like that. But so there's not the competition. So you can't just say like, sorry, there's no way I can compete against this company. There's no way I can even get on the road if you're trying to compete with these people. So it's a little bit more of an open playing field where everyone has an opportunity to succeed. But then you have the Chinese startup culture, which is very chaotic and competitive, backstabbing, whatever you want to call it. And if you can survive that, then you're in a good spot to succeed in China.
One of the key differences between the two countries is the role the government plays at promoting the technology, promoting the companies. For the U.S., the government tends to play more of a regulatory role, whereas in China, the government is much more engaged in the companies themselves. Is this serving China better as far as at least closing the gap with respect to this technology and possibly winning this race?
Well, I would say yes and no, because for one thing, from the U.S. side, vehicles are one of the most highly regulated things in the U.S., like regardless of what you're talking about. And they have regulations at the state level for things like licensing and registration, liability, things like that. And then at the national level for the vehicles themselves, through like the FMVSS, the Federal Motor Vehicle Safety Standards. So that gets a little bit more difficult when you talk about cars that drive themselves, like who is the driver and who is the vehicle? That creates a lot of confusion within insurance and everything like that. But and so that means we're not gonna rush in terms of creating the national standards. But for China, you don't want to have them sort of pick the winners or have them play too active, the government to play too much of an active role in industry. Like we saw, I mentioned in my book about the electric vehicles industry. And they were like very active and saying, we're going to make this many vehicles by 2010. And they had all these things, but no standards for anything, for the charging infrastructure, for anything. And it was a total mess until like Xi Jinping took full control in 2015. And like it made it much more difficult to get the subsidies and things like that. And it flourished after that. Now China makes the most electric vehicles in the world. But so you don't want to have like also state-owned enterprises. You don't want to have the involvement because those are notoriously inefficient and corrupt. Whereas on the U.S. side, we have a lot of tech firms, VCs, and things like that, which are financing all these tech projects, including autonomous vehicles. And also the big tech companies like the Google, now Waymo, Amazon bought Zoox, which is a self-driving car company. And Apple is getting into the act as well. But knowing Apple, we have no idea what they're doing at this point. Yeah. So Apple's super secretive that, I mean, they'll come up with something in a few years, it'll be ready to go, and no one has heard about it until then. Yeah. So who knows what's going to happen with that. It all depends, really. Whether you want the government to be actively supporting an industry like autonomous vehicles or to take a back seat. I think the U.S. is in a sort of it's a sort of touch and go because we don't want to be overly regulated where the vehicles can't even get on the road even for testing. But you don't want to be no regulation at all where the companies can't effectively market their product and to consumers. Commercialize it.
You're listening to Scholar Circle. I'm Doug Becker. We're discussing the race for autonomous vehicles between China and the U.S. with Phil Wilcox. So Now, you said you don't want the government necessarily picking winners and losers, but we're at a specific point in the relationship between the government and big tech, where the U.S. government seems to be prepared to regulate big tech and is much more antagonistic towards big tech than it had been previously. That might be a partisan issue in the U.S., but there certainly seems to be some echoes coming out of Washington about this desire to regulate big tech. Could that have an impact on the race for this technology?
Well, I'm not really sure about that because there's a little bit of two different sides. So for the regulating or controlling the big tech would be sort of the social media networks like the Facebook, Twitter, stuff like that, which are really going under a lot of attack from Congress. Whereas you could say that these vehicles would be big tech because they're essentially computers on wheels. They are very complicated technology, and some of them were produced by tech companies. So you could definitely make the argument that they are the big tech, but I don't know if they would fall directly into that category. And also because some of them are, there's like a GM, the Chevy Cruze, and Ford, the big vehicle manufacturers in the U.S. are also in this race as well. So those companies have typically gotten a lot of support from the federal government for things like bailouts and things like that. So it's hard for me to say whether they'll come into our attack. I think that there will be a lot of questions related to the safety concern, that will definitely be brought up, as well as potential cybersecurity. Vehicles could be hacked. But then we saw in a Wired article for a while that a Jeep Cherokee was hacked, and it wasn't at all autonomous. It was someone took control of it, and he shut off the ignition while the car was on the freeway. So the car just stopped. But then is able to pick back up again when you restart it. So it's not necessarily limited to these self-driving cars. But it's something that I think that the industry really needs to get a handle on this because it's a legitimate concern. And I think the industry needs to have a policy and say, look, we're going to work together on this so there's no problems. We have the best people in the world making these programs as safe as possible, things like that.
And one of the things that struck me in your book was this emphasis that we already have versions of autonomous vehicles, even in the cars that we're driving. You've got the different levels of autonomy. And so it's best to think of autonomous vehicles not as sort of dichotomous. It's either autonomous or it's not, but there's certain levels of autonomy. How far away, though, do you think we are from actually selling vehicles that were, I believe you call them level 5, as opposed to, like, for instance, what we have now, level 2, my own car has, lane assist, that sort of thing. I think you call that level 2 with that. How much of a technological leap do we need to be where we're actually selling cars to consumers that don't require a driver at all? We can all sit in the back seat if we want to.
So I think like for one of these level 2 things like a Tesla, sort of like a misleading statement when they say the now it's even more misleading to say fully self-driving when it's still the level 2, which means you still have to have your hands on the wheel, still have to pay attention and be ready to take over at a moment's notice if something happens. And also, but I mentioned before, those trucks that are following directly behind the other truck, that is also level 2. Because you don't need to have a lot of information of crazy stuff happening when you're just following something very closely. Then that doesn't need a huge technological leap to get to that point. In terms of for the initial rollout, most of the companies say that the initial rollout will be sort of like an Uber for this autonomy. So there won't be the driver, but there will be the autonomy for the car. So that is the initial rollout is being actually already underway in Arizona and Phoenix and the surrounding suburbs by Waymo for Waymo One. And Chevy Cruise is operating a driverless taxi in the Bay Area, San Francisco. So that is actually already underway. And I think that that is the main thing, because the vehicles will be more expensive because of all the new technology, the LiDAR sensors and all the different sensors that I talk about in the book, the light distancing and ranging. But that is something that will be more expensive, but also the prices for those technology are falling. They used to be 10 times more than they are now from the, because they've just been starting to use them in vehicles as of the 2005 DARPA challenge. That was the first time that that the LiDAR was used for vehicles. So they're very new for that. And so the technology will continue to decrease as time goes on. So, you know, in terms of the jump from from two to four or five, I think a lot of the companies say they're at their 90% to 95% to the technology, but it's just that last 5 to 10%, which is the most difficult part, where you have all these sort of edge cases, which are, you know, irregular cases, which happen sometimes, like someone running outside the road or a ball bouncing in front, all this stuff that is very rare, but is hard to program into a car. So, I mean, if you program all of that in, that's like the last 5 to 10% before you get to that point.
Now, you make references in the book about the way in which autonomous vehicles could have an impact on our conversations on global emissions. What exactly is the link between autonomous vehicles and the possibility of emission reduction?
That's a very good point. For one thing is that for it to make sense, if you're trying to run that, they call it the robo-taxi fleet, where you have a company who's operating their autonomous vehicles as like an Uber fleet, then it would make sense for them to all be electric vehicles, because electric vehicles have a lot less wear and tear and they can last much longer than the internal combustion engine cars, which have a lot of different parts involved and things like that. Right now, all the vehicles are actually hybrid because it makes sense for the different sort of like transmission and connections to make everything electric that way. That just makes sense from a technological standpoint and from an engineering standpoint to have it that way. But it would make sense to make them all electric. So that would be one thing. Another thing would be if the companies are operating with the fleet of taxis, then there'd be fewer cars on the road. That would also improve traffic congestion, which is a big deal. And I'm in the DC area, you're in LA, which is a huge deal in both those places. Whether that will continue further on down the line is an open question. And also, even right now we have Nuro, who delivers groceries to people's houses and other products. So a lot of people's driving comes from going to and from grocery stores, say over once per week, maybe 1.5 times per week, something like that. I forget the exact statistic. But if you don't need to take that trip and just get Nuro to deliver to you and to other people as well, then that would also mean you're not on the road. And those are electric vehicles as well. So those are some of the options that could come into play with that.
Interesting. We've just got a couple of minutes left. So do you think the incoming Biden administration is likely to be more supportive, you know, give a little bit more government backing for the development of this technology?
Well, I think that it's actually more of like a bipartisan issue. Just trying to get, this is a new technology development. And especially if you bring in China and say, look, we have a lot of anti-China sentiment right now, regardless if you're talking about Biden, Trump, the Congress, whichever you want to call it, or you want to talk about it. So if you say that they're, hey, if we don't get our foot on the gas, put a foot on the gas here, pun intended, then China could get ahead of us. And then all of a sudden, we're able to import our cars from China now, all of a sudden, because we didn't have our regulation in order. So that is one thing that could push things forward. And it's not necessarily a partisan issue. Like, there's no Republicans on one side, Democrats on the other, even right now when it's hyper-partisan. So that is something that bodes well, I say, for that. And also, when you have like Trump going after like certain states for their vehicle emission standards, California being the prime target, saying that, you know, their vehicle emission standards are something that he's fighting against, we should have that. But Biden is definitely going to get away with that. Move away from that. It says probably promote because one of Biden's chief concerns is climate change. And so he's definitely going to advocate for higher fuel emission standards. And so that's something that is definitely going to propel one, electric vehicles, and hopefully as well that will also bleed into autonomous vehicles as well.
That rare circumstance where competition with China coupled with a desire to deal with climate change might actually build a bipartisan consensus that can certainly hold out hope. We've been discussing the race for the autonomous vehicle, with the technology behind these vehicles, the competition between the U.S. and China, with Philip Wilcox. He has recently written and published a book called The Future is Autonomous, The U.S. and China Race to Develop the Driverless Car. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you to our guests and to you for listening. The Scholar's Circle team includes Doug Becker and Lillian Ng, contributing hosts, Ankine Agassian and Melissa Chiprin, managing producers, Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Tim Page and Mike Hurst, engineers and technical support. I'm Maria Armudian, and we'll see you next week.